decided expression of his wish that she should go and see Mrs. Hale at the time appointed, as most likely to be convenient to the invalid. Mrs. Thornton submitted with as bad a grace as she could to her son's desire, all the time liking him the better for having it, and exaggerating in her own mind the same notion that he had of extraordinary goodness on his part in so perseveringly keeping up with the Hales. His goodness verging on weakness, as all the softer virtues did in her mind, and her own contempt for Mr. and Mrs. Hale and positive dislike to Margaret, were the ideas which occupied Mrs. Thornton till she was struck into nothingness before the dark shadow of the wings of the Angel of Death. There lay Mrs. Hale, a mother like herself, a much younger woman than she was, on the bed from which there was no sign of hope that she might ever rise again. No more variety of light and shade for her in that darkened room. No power of action, scarcely change of movement. Faint alterations of whispered sound and studious silence. And yet that monotonous life seemed almost too much. When Mrs. Thornton, strong and prosperous with life, came in, Mrs. Hale lay still, although from the look on her face she was evidently conscious of who it was. But she did not even open her eyes for a minute or two. The heavy moisture of tears stood on the eyelashes before she looked up. Then, with her hand groping feebly over the bedclothes for the touch of Mrs. Thornton's large firm fingers, she said, scarcely above her breath, Mrs. Thornton had to stoop from her erectness to listen.
"Margaret, you have a daughter. My sister is in Italy. My child will be without a mother, in a strange place. If I die, will you?"
And her filmy, wandering eyes fixed themselves with an intensity of wistfulness on Mrs. Thornton's face. For a minute there was no change in its rigidness. It was stern and unmoved. Nay, but that the eyes of the sick woman were growing dim with the slow gathering tears, she might have seen a dark cloud cross the cold features. And it was no thought of her son or of her living daughter Fanny that stirred her heart at last, but a sudden remembrance suggested by something in the arrangement of the room of a little daughter dead in infancy long years ago, that, like a sudden sunbeam, melted the icy crust behind which there was a real tender woman. "You wish me to be a friend to Miss Hale," said Mrs. Thornton in her measured voice that would not soften with her heart but came out distinct and clear. Mrs. Hale, her eyes still fixed on Mrs. Thornton's face, pressed the hand that lay below hers on the coverlet. She could not speak. Mrs. Thornton sighed. "I will be a true friend, if circumstances require it. Not a tender friend. That I cannot be." "To her," she was on the point of adding, but she relented at the sight of that poor, anxious face. "It is not my nature to show affection, even where I feel it, nor do I volunteer advice in general. Still, at your request, if it will be any comfort to you, I will promise you." Then came a pause. Mrs. Thornton was too conscientious to promise what she did not mean to perform, and to perform anything in the way of kindness on behalf of Margaret, more disliked at this moment than ever, was difficult, almost impossible. "I promise," said she, with grave severity, which, after all, inspired the dying woman with faith as in something more stable than life itself. Flickering, flitting, wavering life. "I promise, but in any difficulty in which Miss Hale—"
"Call her Margaret," gasped Mrs. Hale.
"In which she comes to me for help, I will help her with every power I have, as if she were my own daughter. I also promise that if ever I see her doing what I think is wrong—"
"But Margaret never does wrong, not willfully wrong," pleaded Mrs. Hale.
Mrs. Thornton went on as before, as if she had not heard. "If ever I see her doing what I believe to be wrong, such wrong not touching me or mine, in which case I might be supposed to have an interested motive, I will tell her of it, faithfully and plainly, as I should wish my own daughter to be told." There was a long pause. Mrs. Hale felt that this promise did not include all, and yet it was much. It had reservations in it, which she did not understand. But then she was weak, dizzy, and tired. Mrs. Thornton was reviewing all the probable cases in which she had pledged herself to act. She had a fierce pleasure in the idea of telling Margaret unwelcome truths in the shape of performance of duty. Mrs. Hale began to speak.
"I thank you. I pray God to bless you. I shall never see you again in this world, but my last words are, I thank you for your promise of kindness to my child."
"Not kindness," testified Mrs. Thornton, ungraciously truthful to the last. But having eased her conscience by saying these words, she was not sorry that they were not heard. She pressed Mrs. Hale's soft, languid hand, and rose up and went her way out of the house without seeing a creature. During the time that Mrs. Thornton was having this interview with Mrs. Hale, Margaret and Dixon were laying their heads together and consulting how they should keep Frederick's coming a profound secret to all out of the house. A letter from him might now be expected any day, and he would assuredly follow quickly on its heels. Martha must be sent away on her holiday. Dixon must keep stern guard on the front door, only admitting the few visitors that ever came to the house into Mr. Hale's room downstairs. Mrs. Hale's extreme illness giving her a good excuse for this. If Mary Higgins was required as a help to Dixon in the kitchen, she was to hear and see as little of Frederick as possible. And he was, if necessary, to be spoken of to her under the name of Mr. Dickinson. But her sluggish and incurious nature was the greatest safeguard of all. They resolved that Martha should leave them that very afternoon for this visit to her mother. Margaret wished that she had been sent away on the previous day, as she fancied it might be thought strange to give a servant a holiday when her mistress's state required so much attendance. Poor Margaret! All that afternoon she had to act the part of a Roman daughter and give strength out of her own scanty stock to her father. Mr. Hale would hope, would not despair, between the attacks of his wife's malady. He buoyed himself up in every respite from her pain, and believed that it was the beginning of ultimate recovery. And so, when the paroxysms came on, each more severe than the last, they were fresh agonies and greater disappointments to him. This afternoon he sat in the drawing-room, unable to bear the solitude of his study, or to employ himself in any way. He buried his head in his arms, which lay folded on the table. Margaret's heart ached to see him, yet as he did not speak, she did not like to volunteer any attempt at comfort. Martha was gone. Dixon sat with Mrs. Hale while she slept. The house was very still and quiet, and darkness came on, without any movement to procure candles. Margaret sat at the window, looking out at the lamps and the street, but seeing nothing, only alive to her father's heavy sighs. She did not like to go down for light, lest the tacit restraint of her presence being withdrawn, he might give way to more violent emotion, without her being at hand to comfort him. Yet she was just thinking that she ought to go, and see after the well-doing of the kitchen fire, which there was nobody but herself to attend to, when she heard the muffled door ring with so violent a pull that the wires jingled all through the house, though the positive sound was not great. She started up, passed her father, who had never moved at the veiled dull sound, returned and kissed him tenderly. And still he never moved, nor took any notice of her fond embrace. Then she went down softly through the dark to the door. Dixon would have put the chain on before she opened it, but Margaret had not a thought of fear in her preoccupied mind. A man's tall figure stood between her and the luminous street. He was looking away, but at the sound of the latch he turned quickly round. "Is this Mr. Hales?" said he in a clear, full, delicate voice. Margaret trembled all over. At first she did not answer. In a moment she sighed out, "Frederick!" and stretched out both her hands to catch his and draw him in. "Oh, Margaret," said he, holding her off by her shoulders after they had kissed each other, as if even in that darkness he could see her face and read in its expression a quicker answer to his question than words could give. "My mother, is she alive?"
Yes, she is alive, dear, dear brother. She, as ill as she can be, she is. But alive, she is alive.
Thank God, said he.
Papa is utterly prostrate with this great grief.
You expect me, don't you?
No, we have had no letter.
Then I have come before it. But my mother knows I am coming.
Oh, we all knew you would come. But wait a little. Step in here. Give me your hand. What is this? Oh, your carpet bag. Dixon has shut the shutters, but this is Papa's study, and I can take you to a chair to rest yourself for a few minutes while I go and tell him.
She groped her way to the taper and the lucifer matches. She felt suddenly shy when the little feeble light made them visible. All she could see was that her brother's face was unusually dark in complexion, and she caught the stealthy look of a pair of remarkably long, cut blue eyes that suddenly twinkled up with the droll consciousness of their mutual purpose of inspecting each other. But though the brother and sister had an instant of sympathy in their reciprocal glances, they did not exchange a word. Only Margaret felt sure that she should like her brother as a companion as much as she already loved him as a near relation. Her heart was wonderfully lighter as she went upstairs. The sorrow was no less in reality, but it became less oppressive from having someone in precisely the same relation to it as that in which she stood. Not her father's desponding attitude had power to damp her now. He lay across the table, helpless as ever, but she had the spell by which to rouse him. She used it perhaps too violently in her own great relief.
"Papa," said she, throwing her arms fondly round his neck, pulling his weary head up, in fact, with her gentle violence, till it rested in her arms, and she could look into his eyes and let them gain strength and assurance from hers. "Papa, guess who is here?" He looked at her. She saw the idea of the truth glimmer into their filmy sadness and be dismissed thence as a wild imagination. He threw himself forward and hid his face once more in his stretched-out arms, resting upon the table as heretofore. She heard him whisper. She bent tenderly down to listen.
"I don't know. Don't tell me it is Frederick. Not Frederick. I cannot bear it. I am too weak, and his mother is dying."
He began to cry and wail like a child. It was so different to all which Margaret had hoped and expected that she turned sick with disappointment and was silent for an instant. Then she spoke again, very differently, not so exultingly, far more tenderly and carefully. "Papa, it is Frederick. Think of Mama, how glad she will be. And oh, for her sake, how glad we ought to be. For his sake, too, our poor, poor boy." Her father did not change his attitude, but he seemed to be trying to understand the fact.
"Where is he?"
asked he at last, his face still hidden in his prostrate arms. "In your study, quite alone. I lighted the taper and ran up to tell you. He is quite alone and will be wondering why..."
"I will go to him,"
broke in her father, and he lifted himself up and leant on her arm as on that of a guide. Margaret led him to the study door, but her spirits were so agitated that she felt she could not bear to see the meeting. She turned away and ran upstairs and cried most heartily. It was the first time she had dared to allow herself this relief for days. The strain had been terrible, as she now felt, but Frederick was come. He, the one precious brother, was there, safe amongst them again. She could hardly believe it. She stopped her crying and opened her bedroom door. She heard no sound of voices and almost feared she might have dreamt. She went downstairs and listened at the study door. She heard the buzz of voices, and that was enough. She went into the kitchen and stirred up the fire and lighted the house and prepared for the wanderer's refreshment. How fortunate it was that her mother slept. She knew that she did, from the candle-lighter thrust through the keyhole of her bedroom door. The traveller could be refreshed and bright, and the first excitement of the meeting with his father all be over, before her mother became aware of anything unusual.
When all was ready, Margaret opened the study door and went in like a serving maiden with a heavy tray held in her extended arms. She was proud of serving Frederick, but he, when he saw her, sprang up in a minute and relieved her of her burden. It was a type, a sign, of all the coming relief which his presence would bring. The brother and sister arranged the table together, saying little, but their hands touching and their eyes speaking the natural language of expression, so intelligible to those of the same blood. The fire had gone out, and Margaret applied herself to light it, for the evenings had begun to be chilly, and yet it was desirable to make all noises as distant as possible from Mrs. Hale's room. Dixon says it is a gift to light a fire, not an art to be acquired.
"Poeta nasci tua non fit," murmured Mr. Hale, and Margaret was glad to hear a quotation once more, however languidly given. "Dear old Dixon, how we shall kiss each other," said Frederick. "She used to kiss me, and then look in my face to be sure I was the right person, and then set to again. But, Margaret, what a bungler you are. I never saw such a little awkward, good-for-nothing pair of hands. Run away and wash them, ready to cut bread and butter for me, and leave the fire. I'll manage it. Lighting fires is one of my natural accomplishments."
So Margaret went away and returned and passed in and out of the room in a glad restlessness that could not be satisfied with sitting still. The more wants Frederick had, the better she was pleased, and he understood all this by instinct. It was a joy snatched in the house of mourning, and the zest of it was all the more pungent because they knew in the depths of their hearts what irremediable sorrow awaited them. In the middle, they heard Dixon's foot on the stairs. Mr. Hale started from his languid posture in his great armchair, from which he had been watching his children in a dreamy way, as if they were acting some drama of happiness, which it was pretty to look at, but which was distinct from reality, and in which he had no part. He stood up and faced the door, showing such a strange sudden anxiety to conceal Frederick from the sight of any person entering, even though it were the faithful Dixon, but a shiver came over Margaret's heart. It reminded her of the new fear in their lives. She caught at Frederick's arm and touched it tight, while a stern thought compressed her brows and caused her to set her teeth. And yet they knew it was only Dixon's measured tread. They heard her walk the length of the passage into the kitchen. Margaret rose up.
"I will go to her and tell her, and I shall hear how Mama is."
Mrs. Hale was awake. She rambled at first, but after they had given her some tea she was refreshed, though not disposed to talk. It was better that the night should pass over before she was told of her son's arrival. Dr. Donaldson's appointed visit would bring nervous excitement enough for the evening, and he might tell them how to prepare her for seeing Frederick. He was there, in the house, could be summoned at any moment. Margaret could not sit still. It was a relief to her to aid Dixon in all her preparations for Master Frederick. It seemed as though she never could be tired again. Each glimpse into the room where he sate by his father, conversing with him about she knew not what, nor cared to know, was increase of strength to her. Her own time for talking and hearing would come at last, and she was too certain of this to feel in a hurry to grasp it now. She took in his appearance and liked it. He had delicate features, redeemed from effeminacy by the swarthiness of his complexion and his quick intensity of expression. His eyes were generally merry-looking, but at times they and his mouth so suddenly changed and gave her such an idea of latent passion that it almost made her afraid. But this look was only for an instant and had in it no doggedness, no vindictiveness. It was rather the instantaneous ferocity of expression that comes over the countenances of all natives of wild or southern countries, a ferocity which enhances the charm of the childlike softness into which such a look may melt away. Margaret might fear the violence of the impulsive nature thus occasionally betrayed, but there was nothing in it to make her distrust or recoil in the least from the newfound brother. On the contrary, all their intercourse was peculiarly charming to her from the very first. She knew then how much responsibility she had had to bear, from the exquisite sensation of relief which she felt in Frederick's presence. He understood his father and mother, their characters and their weaknesses, and went along with a careless freedom, which was yet most delicately careful not to hurt or wound any of their feelings. He seemed to know instinctively when a little of the natural brilliancy of his manner and conversation would not jar on the deep depression of his father, or might relieve his mother's pain. Whenever it would have been out of tune and out of time, his patient devotion and watchfulness came into play and made him an admirable nurse. Then Margaret was almost touched into tears by the allusions which he often made to their childish days in the New Forest. He had never forgotten her, or Helston either, all the time he had been roaming among distant countries and foreign people. She might talk to him of the old spot and never fear tiring him. She had been afraid of him before he came, even while she had longed for his coming. 7 or 8 years had, she felt, produced such great changes in herself that, forgetting how much of the original Margaret was left, she had reasoned that if her tastes and feelings had so materially altered, even in her stay-at-home life, his wild career, with which she was but imperfectly acquainted, must have almost substituted another Frederick for the tall stripling in his middies uniform, whom she remembered looking up to with such admiring awe. But in their absence, they had grown nearer to each other in age, as well as in many other things, and so it was that the weight, this sorrowful time, was lightened to Margaret. Other light than that of Frederick's presence she had none. For a few hours the mother rallied on seeing her son. She sate with his hand in hers. She would not part with it even while she slept, and Margaret had to feed him like a baby, rather than that he should disturb her mother by removing a finger. Mrs. Hale wakened while they were thus engaged. She slowly moved her head round on the pillow and smiled at her children as she understood what they were doing and why it was done.
"I am very selfish," said she, "but it will not be for long."
Frederick bent down and kissed the feeble hand that imprisoned his. This state of tranquillity could not endure for many days, nor perhaps for many hours, so Dr. Donaldson assured Margaret. After the kind doctor had gone away, she stole down to Frederick, who during the visit had been adjured to remain quietly concealed in the back parlour, usually Dixon's bedroom, but now given up to him. Margaret told him what Dr. Donaldson said. "I don't believe it," he exclaimed. "She is very ill. She may be dangerously ill, and in immediate danger, too. But I can't imagine that she could be as she is if she were on the point of death. Margaret, she should have some other advice, some London doctor. Have you never thought of that?"
"Yes," said Margaret, "more than once. But I don't believe it would do any good. And you know we have not the money to bring any great London surgeon down, and I am sure Dr. Donaldson is only second in skill to the very best, if indeed he is to them."
Frederick began to walk up and down the room impatiently. "I have credit in Cadiz," said he, "but none here, owing to this wretched change of name. Why did my father leave Helston? That was the blunder."
"It was no blunder," said Margaret gloomily, "and above all possible chances, avoid letting Papa hear anything like what you have just been saying. I can see that he is tormenting himself already with the idea that Mama would never have been ill if we had stayed at Helston, and you don't know Papa's agonizing power of self-reproach."
Frederick walked away as if he were on the quarter-deck. At last he stopped right opposite to Margaret and looked at her drooping and desponding attitude for an instant. "My little Margaret," said he, caressing her, "let us hope as long as we can. Poor little woman, what? Is this face all wet with tears? I will hope, I will, in spite of 1,000 doctors. Bear up, Margaret, and be brave enough to hope." Margaret choked in trying to speak, and when she did it was very low.
"I must try to be meek enough to trust. Oh, Frederick, Mama was getting to love me so, and I was getting to understand her, and now comes death to snap us asunder."
"Come, come, come. Let us go upstairs and do something, rather than waste time that may be so precious. Thinking has many a time made me sad, darling, but doing never did in all my life.
My theory is a sort of parody on the Maximob. Get money, my son, honestly, if you can, but get money. My precept is, do something, my sister. Do good if you can, but at any rate, do something. Not excluding mischief, said Margaret, smiling faintly through her tears. By no means. What I do exclude is the remorse afterwards. Blot your misdeeds out, if you are particularly conscientious. By a good deed, as soon as you can. Just as we did a correct sum at school on the slate, where an incorrect one was only half rubbed out. It was better than wetting our sponge with our tears. Both less loss of time where tears had to be waited for, and a better effect at last. If Margaret thought Frederick's theory rather a rough one at first, she saw how he worked it out into continual production of kindness, in fact. After a bad night with his mother, for he insisted on taking his turn as a sitter-up, he was busy next morning before breakfast, contriving a leg rest for Dixon, who was beginning to feel the fatigues of watching. At breakfast time he interested Mr. Hale with vivid, graphic, rattling accounts of the wildlife he had led in Mexico, South America, and elsewhere. Margaret would have given up the effort in despair to rouse Mr. Hale out of his dejection. It would even have affected herself and rendered her incapable of talking at all. But Fred, true to his theory, did something perpetually, and talking was the only thing to be done besides eating at breakfast. Before the night of that day, Dr. Donaldson's opinion was proved to be too well-founded. Convulsions came on, and when they ceased, Mrs. Hale was unconscious. Her husband might lie by her, shaking the bed with his sobs. Her son's strong arms might lift her tenderly up into a comfortable position. Her daughter's hands might bathe her face, but she knew them not. She would never recognize them again till they met in heaven. Before the morning came, all was over. Then Margaret rose from her trembling and despondency and became as a strong angel of comfort to her father and brother. For Frederick had broken down now, and all his theories were of no use to him. He cried so violently when shut up alone in his little room at night that Margaret and Dixon came down in a fright to warn him to be quiet. For the house partitions were but thin, and the next-door neighbours might easily hear his youthful, passionate sobs, so different from the slower, trembling agony of afterlife, when we become inured to grief, and dare not be rebellious against the inexorable doom, knowing who it is that decrees. Margaret sate with her father in the room with the dead. If he had cried, she would have been thankful. But he sate by the bed quite quietly, only from time to time he uncovered the face and stroked it gently, making a kind of soft, inarticulate noise, like that of some mother animal caressing her young. He took no notice of Margaret's presence. Once or twice she came up to kiss him, and he submitted to it, giving her a little push away when she had done, as if her affection disturbed him from his absorption in the dead. He started when he heard Frederick's cries and shook his head. "Poor boy, poor boy," he said, and took no more notice. Margaret's heart ached within her. She could not think of her own loss in thinking of her father's case. The night was wearing away, and the day was at hand, when without a word of preparation, Margaret's voice broke upon the stillness of the room, with a clearness of sound that startled even herself. "Let not your heart be troubled," it said, and she went steadily on through all that chapter of unspeakable consolation. Chapter 31 Should Old Acquaintance Be Forgot? Show not that manner, and these features all, the serpent's cunning, and the sinner's fall. Crab. The chill, shivery October morning came. Not the October morning of the country, with soft, silvery mists clearing off before the sunbeams that bring out all the gorgeous beauty of colouring, but the October morning of Milton, whose silver mists were heavy fogs, and where the sun could only show long dusky streets when he did break through and shine. Margaret went languidly about, assisting Dixon in her task of arranging the house. Her eyes were continually blinded by tears, but she had no time to give way to regular crying. The father and brother depended upon her. While they were giving way to grief, she must be working, planning, considering. Even the necessary arrangements for the funeral seemed to devolve upon her. When the fire was bright and crackling, when everything was ready for breakfast and the tea kettle was singing away, Margaret gave a last look round the room before going to summon Mr. Hale and Frederick. She wanted everything to look as cheerful as possible, and yet, when it did so, the contrast between it and her own thoughts forced her into sudden weeping. She was kneeling by the sofa, hiding her face in the cushions that no one might hear her cry, when she was touched on the shoulder by Dixon. "Come, Miss Hale, come, my dear. You must not give way, or where shall we all be? There is not another person in the house fit to give a direction of any kind, and there is so much to be done. There's who's to manage the funeral, and who's to come to it, and where it's to be, and all to be settled, and Master Frederick's like one crazed with crying, and Master never was a good one for settling, and poor gentleman, he goes about now as if he was lost. It's bad enough, my dear, I know, but death comes to us all, and you're well off never to have lost any friend till now." Perhaps so, but this seemed a loss by itself, not to bear comparison with any other event in the world. Margaret did not take any comfort from what Dixon said, but the unusual tenderness of the prim old servant's manner touched her to the heart, and more from a desire to show her gratitude for this than for any other reason, she roused herself up and smiled in answer to Dixon's anxious look at her, and went to tell her father and brother that breakfast was ready. Mr. Hale came in as if in a dream, or rather with the unconscious motion of a sleepwalker, whose eyes and mind perceive other things than what are present. Frederick came briskly in, with a forced cheerfulness, grasped her hand, looked into her eyes, and burst into tears. She had to try and think of little nothings to say all breakfast time, in order to prevent the recurrence of her companion's thoughts too strongly to the last meal they had taken together, when there had been a continual strained listening for some sound or signal from the sick room. After breakfast, she resolved to speak to her father about the funeral. He shook his head and assented to all she proposed, though many of her propositions absolutely contradicted one another. Margaret gained no real decision from him and was leaving the room languidly to have a consultation with Dixon when Mr. Hale motioned her back to his side. "Ask Mr. Bell," said he in a hollow voice. "Mr. Bell," said she, a little surprised. "Mr. Bell of Oxford?"
"Mr. Bell," he repeated. "Yes, he was my groomsman."
Margaret understood the association.
"I will write today," said she.
He sank again into listlessness. All morning she toiled on, longing for rest, but in a continual whirl of melancholy business. Towards evening, Dixon said to her,
"I've done it, miss. I was really afraid for Master, that he'd have a stroke with grief. He's been all this day with poor missus, and when I've listened at the door, I've heard him talking to her, and talking to her as if she was alive. When I went in, he would be quite quiet, but all in a maze like. So I thought to myself he ought to be roused, and if it gives him a shock at first, it will maybe be the better afterwards. So I've been and told him that I don't think it's safe for Master Frederick to be here, and I don't. It was only on Tuesday when I was out, but I met a Southampton man, the first I've seen since I came to Milton. They don't make their way much up here, I think. Well, it was young Leonard's, old Leonard's the draper's son, as great a scamp as ever lived, who plagued his father almost to death, and then ran off to sea. I never could abide him. He was in the Orion at the same time as Master Frederick, I know, though I don't recollect if he was there at the mutiny."
"Did he know you?" said Margaret eagerly.
"Why, that's the worst of it. I don't believe he would have known me, but for my being such a fool as to call out his name. He were a Southampton man in a strange place, or else I should never have been so ready to call cousins with him. A nasty, good-for-nothing fellow. Says he, 'Miss Dixon, who would have thought of seeing you here? But perhaps I mistake, and you're Miss Dixon no longer.' so I told him he might still address me as an unmarried lady, though if I hadn't been so particular, I'd had good chances of matrimony. He was polite enough. He couldn't look at me and doubt me. But I were not to be caught with such chaff from such a fellow as him, and so I told him. And by way of being even, I asked him after his father, who I knew had turned him out of doors, as if they was the best friends as ever was. So then, to spite me, for you see we were getting savage, for all we were so civil to each other, he began to inquire after Master Frederick, and said with a scrape he'd got into, as if Master Frederick's scrapes would ever wash George Leonard's white or make him look otherwise than nasty, dirty black, and how he'd be hung for mutiny if ever he were caught, and how £100 reward had been offered for catching him, and what a disgrace he had been to his family. All to spite me, you see, my dear, because before now I've helped old Mr. Leonard's to give George a good rating down in Southampton. So I said there were other families, as I knew, who had far more cause to blush for their sons, and to be thankful if they could think they were earning an honest living far away from home. To which he made answer, like the impudent chap he is, but he were in a confidential situation, and if I knew of any young man who had been so unfortunate as to lead vicious courses, and wanted to turn steady, he'd have no objection to lend him his patronage. He, indeed! Why, he'd corrupt a saint. I've not felt so bad myself for years as when I was standing talking to him the other day. I could have cried to think I couldn't spite him better, but he kept smiling in my face, as if he took all my compliments for earnest. And I couldn't see that he minded what I said in the least, while I was mad with all his speeches.
But you did not tell him anything about us, about Frederick?
Not I, said Dixon. He had never the grace to ask where I was staying, and I shouldn't have told him if he had asked. Nor did I ask him what his precious situation was. He was waiting for a bus, and just then it drove up and he hailed it. But to plague me to the last, he turned back before he got in and said, "If you can help me to trap Lieutenant Hale, Miss Dixon, we'll go partners in the reward. I know you'd like to be my partner now, wouldn't you? Don't be shy, but say yes." And he jumped on the bus, and I saw his ugly face leering at me with a wicked smile to think how he'd had the last word of plaguing. Margaret was made very uncomfortable by this account of Dixon's.
"Have you told Frederick?" asked she.
"No," said Dixon. "I were uneasy in my mind at knowing that bad Leonard's was in town. But there was so much else to think about that I did not dwell on it at all. But when I saw Master sitting so stiff and with his eyes so glazed and sad, I thought it might rouse him to have to think of Master Frederick's safety a bit. So I told him all, though I blushed to say how a young man had been speaking to me. And it has done Master good. And if we're to keep Master Frederick in hiding, he would have to go, poor fellow, before Mr. Bell came.
Oh, I'm not afraid of Mr. Bell, but I am afraid of this Leonard's. I must tell Frederick. What did Leonard's look like?
A bad-looking fellow, I can assure you, miss. Whiskers, such as I should be ashamed to wear. They are so red. And for all he said, he'd got a confidential situation. He was dressed in fustian just like a working man.
It was evident that Frederick must go. Go, too, when he had so completely vaulted into his place in the family, and promised to be such a stay and staff to his father and sister. Go when his cares for the living mother and sorrow for the dead seemed to make him one of those peculiar people who are bound to us by a fellow love for them that are taken away. Just as Margaret was thinking all this, sitting over the drawing-room fire, her father restless and uneasy under the pressure of this newly aroused fear, of which he had not as yet spoken, Frederick came in, his brightness dimmed, but the extreme violence of his grief passed away. He came up to Margaret and kissed her forehead.
"How wan you look, Margaret," said he in a low voice. "You have been thinking of everybody, and no one has thought of you. Lie on this sofa. There is nothing for you to do."
"That is the worst," said Margaret in a sad whisper. But she went and laid down, and her brother covered her feet with a shawl, and then sate on the ground by her side, and the two began to talk in a subdued tone. Margaret told him all that Dixon had related of her interview with young Leonard's. Frederick's lips closed with the long whew of dismay. I should just like to have it out with that young fellow. A worse sailor was never on board ship, nor a much worse man either. I declare, Margaret, you know the circumstances of the whole affair.
Yes, Mama told me.
Well, when all the sailors who were good for anything were indignant with our captain, this fellow, to curry favour, pah, meant to think of his being here. Oh, if he'd a notion I was within 20 miles of him, he'd ferret me out to pay off old grudges. I'd rather anybody had the £100 they think I am worth than that rascal. What a pity poor old Dixon could not be persuaded to give me up and make a provision for her old age. Oh, Frederick, hush, don't talk so. Mr. Hale came towards them, eager and trembling. He had overheard what they were saying. He took Frederick's hand in both of his.
My boy, you must go. It is very bad, but I see you must. You have done all you could. You have been a comfort to her.
Oh, Papa, must he go? Said Margaret, pleading against her own conviction of necessity.
I declare I've a good mind to face it out and stand my trial. If I could only pick up my evidence. I cannot endure the thought of being in the power of such a blackguard as Leonard's. I could almost have enjoyed, in other circumstances, this stolen visit. It has had all the charm which the Frenchwoman attributed to forbidden pleasures.
One of the earliest things I can remember, said Margaret, was your being in some great disgrace, Fred, for stealing apples. We had plenty of our own, trees loaded with them, but someone had told you that stolen fruit tasted sweetest, which you took au pied de la lettre, and off you went a-robbing. You have not changed your feelings much since then.
Yes, you must go, repeated Mr. Hale, answering Margaret's question, which she had asked some time ago. His thoughts were fixed on one subject, and it was an effort to him to follow the zigzag remarks of his children, an effort which he did not make. Margaret and Frederick looked at each other. That quick momentary sympathy would be theirs no longer if he went away. So much was understood through eyes that could not be put into words. Both caused the same thought till it was lost in sadness. Frederick shook it off first.
Do you know, Margaret, I was very nearly giving both Dixon and myself a good fright this afternoon. I was in my bedroom. I had heard a ring at the front door, but I thought the ringer must have done his business and gone away long ago, so I was on the point of making my appearance in the passage, when, as I opened my room door, I saw Dixon coming downstairs, and she frowned and kicked me into hiding again. I kept the door open and heard a message given to some man that was in my father's study, and that then went away.
Who could it have been? Some of the shopmen?
Very likely, said Margaret indifferently. There was a little quiet man who came up for orders about 2 o'clock.
But this was not a little man, a great powerful fellow, and it was past 4 when he was here.
It was Mr. Thornton, said Mr. Hale.
They were glad to have drawn him into the conversation.
Mr. Thornton, said Margaret, a little surprised. I thought...
Well, little one, what did you think? Asked Frederick, as she did not finish her sentence.
Oh, only, said she, reddening and looking straight at him, I fancied you meant someone of a different class, not a gentleman, somebody come on an errand.
He looked like someone of that kind, said Frederick carelessly. I took him for a shopman, and he turns out a manufacturer. Margaret was silent. She remembered how at first, before she knew his character, she had spoken and thought of him just as Frederick was doing. It was but a natural impression that was made upon him, and yet she was a little annoyed by it. She was unwilling to speak. She wanted to make Frederick understand what kind of person Mr. Thornton was, but she was tongue-tied. Mr. Hale went on.
He came to offer any assistance in his power, I believe, but I could not see him. I told Dixon to ask him if he would like to see you. I think I asked her to find you, and you would go to him. I don't know what I said.
He has been a very agreeable acquaintance, has he not? Asked Frederick, throwing the question like a ball for anyone to catch who chose.
A very kind friend, said Margaret, when her father did not answer.
Frederick was silent for a time. At last he spoke.
Margaret,
It is painful to think I can never thank those who have shown you kindness. Your acquaintances and mine must be separate, unless, indeed, I run the chances of a court-martial, or unless you and my father would come to Spain. He threw out this last suggestion as a kind of feeler, and then suddenly made the plunge. You don't know how I wish you would. I have a good position, the chance of a better, continued he, reddening like a girl. That Dolores Barbour that I was telling you of, Margaret, I only wish you knew her. I am sure you would like, no, love is the right word. Like is so poor. You would love her, father, if you knew her. She is not 18, but if she is in the same mind another year, she is to be my wife. Mr. Barbour won't let us call it an engagement, but if you would come, you would find friends everywhere besides Dolores. Think of it, father. Margaret, be on my side. No, no more removals for me, said Mr. Hale. One removal has cost me my wife. No more removals in this life. She will be here, and here I will stay out my appointed time.
Oh, Frederick, said Margaret, tell us more about her. I never thought of this, but I am so glad. You will have someone to love and care for you out there. Tell us all about it.
In the first place, she is a Roman Catholic. That's the only objection I anticipated. But my father's change of opinion... Nay, Margaret, don't sigh.
Margaret had reason to sigh a little more before the conversation ended. Frederick himself was Roman Catholic, in fact, though not in profession as yet. This was then the reason why his sympathy in her extreme distress at her father's leaving the church had been so faintly expressed in his letters. She had thought it was the carelessness of a sailor, but the truth was that even then he was himself inclined to give up the form of religion into which he had been baptized, only that his opinions were tending in exactly the opposite direction to those of his father. How much love had to do with this change, not even Frederick himself could have told. Margaret gave up talking about this branch of the subject at last, and returning to the fact of the engagement, she began to consider it in some fresh light. But for her sake, Fred, you surely will try and clear yourself of the exaggerated charges brought against you, even if the charge of mutiny itself be true. If there were to be a court-martial, and you could find your witnesses... You might at any rate show how your disobedience to authority was because that authority was unworthily exercised.
Mr. Hale roused himself up to listen to his son's answer. In the first place, Margaret, who is to hunt up my witnesses? All of them are sailors, drafted off to other ships, except those whose evidence would go for very little, as they took part or sympathized in the affair. In the next place, allow me to tell you, you don't know what a court-martial is, and consider it as an assembly where justice is administered instead of what it really is, a court where authority weighs 9/10 in the balance and evidence forms only the other 10th. In such cases, evidence itself can hardly escape being influenced by the prestige of authority.
But is it not worth trying to see how much evidence might be discovered and arrayed on your behalf? At present, all those who knew you formerly believe you guilty without any shadow of excuse. You have never tried to justify yourself, and we have never known where to seek for proofs of your justification. Now, for Miss Barbour's sake, make your conduct as clear as you can in the eye of the world. She may not care for it. She has, I am sure, that trust in you that we all have. But you ought not to let her ally herself to one under such a serious charge, without showing the world exactly how it is you stand. You disobeyed authority. That was bad. But to have stood by, without word or act, while the authority was brutally used, would have been infinitely worse. People know what you did, but not the motives that elevate it out of a crime into an heroic protection of the weak. For Dolores' sake, they ought to know.
But how must I make them know? I am not sufficiently sure of the purity and justice of those who would be my judges to give myself up to a court-martial. Even if I could bring a whole array of truth-speaking witnesses, I can't send a bellman about to cry aloud and proclaim in the streets what you are pleased to call my heroism. No one would read a pamphlet of self-justification so long after the deed, even if I put one out.
"Will you consult a lawyer as to your chances of exculpation?" asked Margaret, looking up and turning very red. "I must first catch my lawyer and have a look at him and see how I like him before I make him into my confidant. Many a briefless barrister might twist his conscience into thinking that he could earn £100 very easily by doing a good action in giving me, a criminal, up to justice." "Nonsense, Frederick, because I know a lawyer on whose honour I can rely, of whose cleverness in his profession people speak very highly, and who would, I think, take a good deal of trouble for any of Aunt Shaw's relations, Mr. Henry Lennox, Papa."
"I think it is a good idea," said Mr. Hale, "but don't propose anything which will detain Frederick in England. Don't, for your mother's sake."
"You could go to London tomorrow evening by a night train," continued Margaret, warming up into her plan. "He must go tomorrow, I'm afraid, Papa," she said tenderly. "We fixed that because of Mr. Bell and Dixon's disagreeable acquaintance."
"Yes, I must go tomorrow," said Frederick decidedly. Mr. Hale groaned. "I can't bear to part with you, and yet I am miserable with anxiety as long as you stop here."
"Well, then," said Margaret, "listen to my plan. He gets to London on Friday morning. I will, you might, no, it would be better for me to give him a note to Mr. Lennox. You will find him at his chambers in the Temple."
"I will write down a list of all the names I can remember on board the Orion. I could leave it with him to ferret them out. He is Edith's husband's brother, isn't he? I remember your naming him in your letters. I have money in Barbour's hands. I can pay a pretty long bill, if there is any chance of success. Money, dear father, that I had meant for a different purpose, so I shall only consider it as borrowed from you and Margaret."
"Don't do that," said Margaret. "You won't risk it if you do, and it will be a risk, only it is worth trying. You can sail from London as well as from Liverpool?"
"To be sure, little goose. Wherever I feel water heaving under a plank, there I feel at home. I'll pick up some craft or other to take me off, never fear. I won't stay 24 hours in London, away from you on the one hand, and from somebody else on the other."
It was rather a comfort to Margaret that Frederick took it into his head to look over her shoulder as she wrote to Mr. Lennox. If she had not been thus compelled to write steadily and concisely on, she might have hesitated over many a word and been puzzled to choose between many an expression, in the awkwardness of being the first to resume the intercourse of which the concluding event had been so unpleasant to both sides. However, the note was taken from her before she had even had time to look it over, and treasured up into a pocket-book, out of which fell a long lock of black hair, the sight of which caused Frederick's eyes to glow with pleasure.
"Now you would like to see that, wouldn't you?" said he. "No, you must wait until you see her herself. She is too perfect to be known by fragments. No mean brick shall be a specimen of the building of my palace."
Chapter 32. Mischances. What remained to be denounced, dragged, it may be, in chains. Vanna. All the next day they sate together, they three. Mr. Hale hardly ever spoke but when his children asked him questions and forced him, as it were, into the present. Frederick's grief was no more to be seen or heard. The first paroxysm had passed over, and now he was ashamed of having been so battered down by emotion. And though his sorrow for the loss of his mother was a deep, real feeling and would last out his life, it was never to be spoken of again. Margaret, not so passionate at first, was more suffering now. At times she cried a good deal, and her manner, even when speaking on indifferent things, had a mournful tenderness about it, which was deepened whenever her looks fell on Frederick, and she thought of his rapidly approaching departure. She was glad he was going, on her father's account, however much she might grieve over it on her own. The anxious terror in which Mr. Hale lived, lest his son should be detected and captured, far outweighed the pleasure he derived from his presence. The nervousness had increased since Mrs. Hale's death, probably because he dwelt upon it more exclusively. He started at every unusual sound, a and was never comfortable unless Frederick sat out of the immediate view of anyone entering the room. Towards evening, he said, "You will go with Frederick to the station, Margaret. I shall want to know he is safely off. You will bring me word that he is clear of Milton at any rate."
"Certainly," said Margaret. "I shall like it if you won't be lonely without me, Papa."
"No, no. I should always be fancying someone had known him, and that he had been stopped, unless you could tell me you had seen him off. And go to the Outwood station. It is quite as near, and not so many people about. Take a cab there. There is less risk of his being seen. What time is your train, Fred?"
6:10. Very nearly dark. So what will you do, Margaret?"
"Oh, I can manage. I'm getting very brave and very hard. It is a well-lighted road all the way home, if it should be dark. But I was out last week much later."
Margaret was thankful when the parting was over, the parting from the dead mother and the living father. She hurried Frederick into the cab in order to shorten a scene which she saw was so bitterly painful to her father, who would accompany his son as he took his last look at his mother. Partly in consequence of this, and partly owing to one of the very common mistakes in the railway guide as to the times when trains arrive at the smaller stations, they found on reaching Outwood that they had nearly 20 minutes to spare. The booking office was not open, so they could not even take the ticket. They accordingly went down the flight of steps that led to the level of the ground below the railway. There was a broad cinder path diagonally crossing a field which lay alongside of the carriage road, and they went there to walk backwards and forwards for the few minutes they had to spare. Margaret's hand lay in Frederick's arm. He took hold of it affectionately. "Margaret, I'm going to consult Mr. Lennox as to the chance of exculpating myself, so that I may return to England whenever I choose, more for your sake than for the sake of anyone else. I can't bear to think of your lonely position if anything should happen to my father. He looks sadly changed, terribly shaken. I wish you could get him to think of the Cadiz plan, for many reasons. What could you do if he were taken away? You have no friend near. We are curiously bare of relations." Margaret could hardly keep from crying at the tender anxiety with which Frederick was bringing before her an event which she herself felt was not very improbable, so severely had the cares of the last few months told upon Mr. Hale. But she tried to rally as she said, "There have been such strange, unexpected changes in my life during these last 2 years that I feel more than ever that it is not worthwhile to calculate too closely what I should do if any future event took place. I try to think only upon the present." She paused. They were standing still for a moment, close on the field side of the stile leading into the road. The setting sun fell on their faces. Frederick held her hand in his and looked with wistful anxiety into her face, reading there more care and trouble than she would betray by words. She went on, "We shall write to one another, and I will promise, for I see it will set your mind at ease, to tell you every worry I have. Papa is..." She started a little, a hardly visible start, but Frederick felt the sudden motion of the hand he held and turned his full face to the road, along which a horseman was slowly riding, just passing the very stile where they stood. Margaret bowed. Her bow was stiffly returned. "Who is that?" said Frederick, almost before he was out of hearing. Margaret was a little drooping, a little flushed, as she replied, "Mr. Thornton. You saw him before, you know."
"Only his back. He is an unprepossessing-looking fellow. What a scowl he has."
"Something has happened to vex him," said Margaret apologetically. "You would not have thought him unprepossessing if you had seen him with Mama."
"I fancy it must be time to go and take my ticket. If I had known how dark it would be, we wouldn't have sent back the cab, Margaret."
"Oh, don't fidget about that. I can take a cab here, if I like, or go back by the railroad, when I should have shops and people and lamps all the way from the Milton station house. Don't think of me. Take care of yourself. I am sick with the thought that Leonard's may be in the same train with you. Look well into the carriage before you get in."
They went back to the station. Margaret insisted upon going into the full light of the flaring gas inside to take the ticket. Some idle-looking young men were lounging about with the station master. Margaret thought she had seen the face of one of them before, and returned him a proud look of offended dignity for his somewhat impertinent stare of undisguised admiration. She went hastily to her brother, who was standing outside, and took hold of his arm.